Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets move up around the world. They break their losing streak. But is it nothing more than a dead cat bounce or maybe the start of a new rally? Bernanke sparks a great move in the markets by saying, well, nothing. Correlations are extremely high when it comes to ETFs, stocks, and futures. We'll talk about that and lots more on this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here. How are you? Episode number 227 for the last week of August 2011. And we have some great guests to cover the topics that we really need to know about. First, we have Professor Charles Nenner, who is an expert on cycles. On cycles, like the cyclicality of movement of markets. And we're going to talk to him and then bring on after that a good friend of ours, John Markman, because I really want to get into the discussion about futures, ETFs, and grand movements of the markets that may be really outside of the simplicity of stock buying. So we're going to talk about that and get into some of the more finer details with that. Before we do so, I want to mention that obviously it's been quite a summer when it comes to markets, and the volatility has been extraordinary. I'm not talking about just from the VIX or just the movement, but if you look back in history, and we did a study on this last week, the last, let's call it 6 months, has seen some of the greatest volatility, the greatest moves, and some call it Six Sigma events in the markets that we've seen in a very long time, if ever. In fact, when you look at the amount of variation and ranges of market movements on a daily basis, there's been several, including Friday's, that was 5% from top to bottom in one day. Not just all down, not just all up, but somewhere in between. And plenty just straight up and plenty straight down. Probably getting you a little unnerved, I could imagine. But at the same time, it may provide some opportunity if you play it right. What we're doing with our portfolios, we have a combination, obviously, our more diversified global allocations. We've taken a lot out of the market a couple of months back and have a pretty low exposure to equities for the moment. We have a little while to go, in our opinion, before we can feel a little more comfortable with not only the economics, but the levels of the various markets around the world, that there'll be some kind of a support level. And then we've actually cleaned out a lot of bonds over the last few weeks, too, because we think they're getting a little toppy. So we have bulks of cash that we're looking to do with something with right now. But with the economics being so uncertain, it's a smart thing to kind of just take a breath. You don't have to rush into anything. You have a long life and a long and healthy portfolio opportunity ahead of you. Let's be honest. So we've kind of been sneaking a little bit out here and there and really not doing a lot of reinvestment there. In our more aggressive and our more trading-oriented portfolios, we've kind of actually moved into, I think, about four or five stocks right now. And we were completely out 2 weeks ago. And slowly but surely, we inched back into a few. And they've actually done very well. I'm very pleased with that. We added a couple on Friday, so now we have a total of five. And we've been trading around that, utilizing some ETFs to try to get a little bit of benefit, a little bit of extra from the volatility. Last week wasn't the most successful. The week before that was very successful. So you have to look at this as an opportunity to work within the volatility as opposed to just plainly plunking money in there, because if you have any kind of discipline, folks, and you have any kind of level of sell stops that you're going to abide by, you got a problem. One of the things that we've also been discussing a lot is, here at least, we've been talking about, you know, what's the right and most appropriate level of a sell stop? I mean, you can use a number like, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10%. And what happens on those days that you see these wild rides on the markets that you automatically going to get stopped out? I think that right now you need to expand, if you're going to do this, you really need to expand your sell stops, because a simple 6% may not do it. If you're in a market that has a variation of 4 or 5%, an individual stock may have a 7 or 8% daily move, and you'll be called out all the time. So just think about that as something you want to consider. We have a lot to talk about with our guest today. Before we do so, I just want to mention that GoToMeeting is obviously a sponsor of the show, and I want to mention them because they're a great sponsor and it's something you need to check out. And especially when it comes time to things like, as crazy it may sound, like school meetings, you know, just simply being able to be at really two places at once. GoToMeeting is one of these things where you just easily can put your information on your screen and a multitude of people can share it with you. So your meeting materials are viewed on everybody's screen seamlessly. And, you know, the nice thing is that you don't know the technology level of the people that you're talking to. So they don't really have to install anything major. They don't have to go through the trouble of understanding everything about the technicalities of this whole thing. It's very easy. They just click a button, shows up on their screen, and all of a sudden they're sharing your screen, and you can have voice over IP and presenting all the information that you want, whether it's school or business or whatever it may be, whether it's here in China, it's all over the world. You could easily just simply just share what you're doing and have communication that is just amazing. So the nice thing is that if you want to check it out, you can do so for free, and that's a month of unlimited meetings for absolutely zero cost. You just have to go to gotomeeting.com, click on the try it free button, and enter the promo code podcast. I encourage you to do this, especially the start of kind of like the next cycle of the year and the next quarter and kind of through the summer and through Labor Day. Check this out. If you haven't done it, just for fun, see what it's like. gotomeeting.com, promo code podcast. So let's get right into our discussion with our first guest, Professor Charles Nenner. And the best way probably to describe him is an expert in cycles. Professor, would you agree that is something that we could probably say is your expertise, the whole idea of cycles?
One of the things we do is cycles, correct.
So it's kind of fascinating to me about the cycles because there's different lengths of time that you actually can look at to find similarities. And is the thesis that when you're looking at cycles that everything repeats itself concept?
Right, right. So like summer and winter, there's an exact time cycle that gives the amount of days between tops and bottoms. Mm-hmm. Of course, you got long-term cycles, yearly, monthly cycles, so that gives you a major high to a major high, and in between you get a small high to a small high and a small low to a small low, and it's almost 100% correlation. It almost looks like there's no free will in the market. You can't predict exactly what's going to happen when, and the news always follows.
It is kind of odd that you have a interesting trend where when there's a lot of bad news, it seems to be bunched up in a small, tight time frame, isn't there?
Yes, but the news comes out when the cycles are down because the news is all over the place. We know it, but we don't pay attention. So when a cycle is down, then humanity starts thinking about anything that can go wrong.
Yeah.
And then they say that's when the market goes down, but actually it's the end result of a negative attitude towards news already.
It's kind of what we're tuning into, I guess, because there's times that we want to tune into the positive, even though things may not be, so we tune out the negative, right?
Right. So I remember when we were selling at 13.49, we were selling all our long positions, and I wrote in my newsletter, whoever can explain why he wants to be long, I'm interested, because I know I want to be short. And nobody actually knew why it was long. So what happened since then? Almost nothing happened. There was 1 week number. And since then, the markets are down 20%.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe there was such a big news item that deserves the market to crash by 20%.
Right. So you have this newsletter that you put out, I know. And a lot of it, you talk about things like various sectors and crude and euro. You talk about this whole issue. For example, you say in your last update, the euro. Euro refuses to go down. You said around September 1st is the cycle low, and we're getting ready
right.
to go long the euro, which is actually fascinating because it really defies any logic.
Well, I don't know so much what the logic is. The logic is that everybody's in trouble, and who's the least in trouble, that currency goes up.
Yeah, it seems, I guess, that way. And
yeah.
So these are things you kind of go with, and you talked about you know, gold and maybe the whole gold issue and cycles. We expect trouble by the third week of September. So what's your kind of midterm cycle here from here forward going for, let's say, U.S. markets and emerging markets, if you can break those down?
Well, mostly they go in tandem. Just one goes up a little bit more than the other one. Now, we said the major low that we're looking for is somewhere in October. and then we get a rally. But in 2012, we think the whole thing turns sour again. And as you know, it has been out there, my target for the Dow Jones is 5,000. So I think we'll have not a recession. I think we'll have a depression.
That's a low number. So that would mean that the that would mean that the S&P should be somewhere in the neighborhood about 600, 700?
Yeah, even lower, 500, 400, 450.
That's pretty impressive. Now, do you use like an Elliott wave concept at all, or are you just pretty much doing cycles that you've identified?
No, I developed a different system. That Elliott wave always is questionable. You know, it can go 1.6, 2.6, 0.6, 1.8. We have developed a mathematical system that takes the momentum that a stock goes up or down and then exactly can calculate the end point, how high it will go and how low it will go. So it's not different scenarios and let's see where it goes. It's one exact number.
Right. So it's kind of, I mean, it may not be the exact same thing, but kind of like a GAN sequence or a Fibonacci time sequence combined with a price sequence and projection. I mean, conceptually.
Yeah. To say about GAN, I never really totally understood it. So I'm not following GAN because it's too difficult for me.
Yeah.
But we're doing okay. If somebody wants to see it, it's they go to Charles Nanner Research Center. We have a presentation we did for Bloomberg of 1 hour, and it explains exactly how we're doing it.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Last question I have for you is, now these cycles, do these cycles, in your opinion, are they consistent and better signals on a particular sector, financial, versus others? Like, are they better with currencies than they are for financial assets?
That's a very good question. The cycles are a projection of human behavior. Now, the more people are involved, the less free choice there is. So if you take a stock that only has four or five people holding it, it's difficult because there is somebody who could have a free choice and go against the masses. But if you have huge markets, and everybody listens to the same news, and everybody is involved by the other people, there's no free choice. That's what it's built on. So the more people involved, the bigger liquidity in the stock, the better it works.
Interesting. Okay, Charles, Professor Charles Nanner, all the way from Amsterdam. I appreciate your time, and I guess that people can check out your newsletter and things that you have available on Nanner Research. And I look forward to reading some more of your things in the future. I think it's quite fascinating, and it's a little bit
different.
Okay,
we'll do it again.
Yeah, appreciate it. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, now, so we talked about how we are going to get into a discussion about what is moving the markets, right? So we talked about the idea that there's some correlation going on with indices and with the individual stocks, pretty high. And what I thought we'd do is we'd have someone who really knows this area, and a good friend of mine, John Markman, who is an author, a money manager, newsletter. He's with Markman Capital, and he actually has some things about futures, which we're going to get into because we really haven't talked about that, I don't think at all, in the last number of years. So, John Markman, all the way from Seattle, how are you? I'm pretty good, thank you. There's so much that I want to ask you because you and I talk often, and one of the things we talked about just a couple of days ago was the whole idea of futures. So, what I wanted to start off with, because I think it's a, you know, people know about options, they know about some of those kind of derivative plays, but for the layperson, like somebody that has never understood or known about what a futures contract is. Tell me kind of how that works.
Well, futures were first devised to help farmers and other raw materials producers even out their earnings over the course of a season.
Right.
So if you're if you grow corn and you're happy with getting a particular dollar amount over the next three growing seasons, you can swap the risk that you have in that prices of corn may drop, with a counterparty who is willing to bet that you're making a wrong assumption about corn prices.
Right.
So futures are really all about hedging and speculation. On the one hand, the person who has something wants to hedge out a risk that he has, and on the other hand, the counterparty wants to bet the other way.
Right. So now,
That has been taken to a whole other level with the indexes, because people who have large stock positions may want to hedge out the value of their position using derivatives, index derivatives, which are what futures are. By let's say you have a long S&P 500 position, and you're worried that it might fall, so you might buy short some futures, which allow you to hedge out that risk.
Mm-hmm.
But as you might imagine, the person on the other side of that bet is not really hedging anything. He's a speculator.
Right.
And that's where most of the people who you hear about in the futures market today are. Well, we're speculators bidding on an outcome against another speculator who is bidding on a different outcome. And the reason that the futures market is so so important is that it's very, very liquid, and it's very leveraged. You know, for as an example, if you put up $5,000 in margin, you can control $56,000 in S&P 500 E-mini futures.
Wow.
So it's a tremendous bet, and it gets even crazier. You know, if you put up $1,000, you can control $200,000 worth of two-year note futures.
Wow.
So you're leveraged 2,000 to 1. So the move doesn't have to be very large in your favor for you to make a lot of money in the futures, and that's why the big boys play that way. That's why all the big hedge funds play this way, because they may have $1 billion, but that's never good enough for them.
Right.
They want to act as if they have $10 billion, and they can do that through the futures market.
So now, one of the big things that I've talked about, and you and I have talked about, and I've written about, is this whole idea that there is this right now, in particular right now, a very high correlation between individual securities and indices. Now, that's not always the case. Sometimes you hear things like, oh, it's a stock picker's market. But what's happening now is this high correlation lends me to believe, that what's happening is more of ETF and futures driven. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and it's a much greater extent than people realize. You know, in the past, the big funds, I never used to bother with ETFs, or certainly never mess with mutual funds and didn't mess with ETFs. But now the large hedge funds are using ETFs as a hedging vehicle, and that's part of what is exacerbating the big moves that we're seeing in the past month.
Right, because what happens is, and this is kind of the interesting thing, when you say that you're going to take 2,000, 5,000, 10,000, leverage it up to, I'm picking a number, 100,000 or whatever you're doing in terms of the S&P futures, when you actually are buying that, it's not just a futures contract. It actually has an effect on the actual stock market and thus the underlying stocks.
Yes, when you buy an ETF, they create a synthetic position for you. But that synthetic position actually impacts the value of all the underlying stocks within the S&P 500 if you're buying the SPDR as an example.
So for the small amount of money, essentially, what can happen is that that a large movement can happen. Take, for example, last week, there was a lot of volatility there, but something interesting happened. The indices got close to, the S&P got close to somewhere of a test of, not the low, but of a mid-level low, and all of a sudden turned around, bounced, and that doesn't happen just because, right, everybody's running out, all these investors are running out, and they had all these buy orders there. What's happening really is that there is a play for, hey, the chances are that it's going to bounce. Many of the algorithms know this, the machines, and they pick up the futures, they pick up the ETFs, and it runs it. If it doesn't, they'll just dump it.
Right, and it's not just, I think that the importance of the ETFs in the world of hedge funds hedging is very important, but much more important is the high-frequency trading.
Yeah.
Because those guys pick up trends very quickly, and they run them to their maximum until their machines tell them to turn around. And those guys are like really like spreading gasoline on a fire.
Yeah,
they are accelerating the movements of stocks in both directions.
I got to tell you,
in ways, by the way, that we've never seen before.
Right,
and in ways that a lot of the technical analysts have not truly accounted for in their models.
You know, technical and fundamental, for that matter, because the problem is that things are moving on, as you say, directionally and trends, and while that's more aligned towards technical, it's totally the opposite side of the world from fundamental analysis.
You know, you can't get the technicals too far misaligned from the fundamentals. That doesn't really happen. But once the technicals and the fundamentals are moving in the same direction, it is a powerful force.
Yeah.
So as an example, on the move down from 1370 to 1100, you know, was that a technical move or was that a fundamental move?
Yes.
Well, if you think a recession is coming, if people believed at 1370 when they began to sell that a recession is coming, then it was a fundamental move.
Right.
And in fact, if it's a fundamental move in which a recession, a global synchronized recession is coming, then it's a fundamental move that has not completed yet.
Right.
Because most likely the stocks have got to go a lot lower to discount a full global synchronized recession.
Now,
so on the one hand,
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I have so many questions I want to ask you. I'm like anxious. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So, no, I just want to say that. So on the one hand, you can look at it and say, well, that was a very technical move. The market moved from a high down to 1,100, which was an area that was first it moved to 1,250, which broke a head and shoulders top, which mm-hmm. is a technical move. And then once it broke the technical top, head and shoulders top, the market moved right to 1,100, which was the level that was foretold by the break of the head and shoulders top. So that was technical, sure. But at the same time, if you look at the fundamentals and look what people are looking forward to in the future in terms of reduced earnings, that is a level that can be justified on a fundamental basis.
But a couple of things on that. First of all, we're seeing some companies clearly state that there's a lot of uncertainty about the future. There is concern about things. But analysts, if you see them, and the ones that are pretty outspoken, particularly those on TV, have said that, hey, we're not really taking down our numbers a lot. We think we're going to still hit a high, an all-time high in the S&P 500, and next year is going to see continued growth. And one of the things they say quite often, as a matter of fact, all the time, is given the current set of data that we're seeing now, stocks are cheap. And I find that so laughable because, you know, you look at things and you have to realize, no matter who you are and what's going on, unless there is some kind of very bizarre circumstance, the stock market essentially is always right because it is where it is. And to say that stocks are cheap right now is constantly trying to find reason to just buy, because I don't think I've seen in, besides maybe a handful of people that have said that, you know, stocks are going to go much lower. I mean, on TV and in the media, it's all about stocks going higher and what to buy. Don't you think?
Well, to me, Andrew, it all pivots around one central question. If you can answer this question in your own mind, you'll have the key to Rebecca. The big question is, will there be a U.S. recession, and or will there be a global synchronized recession? If you think that there will not be a recession, then stocks are too cheap and they should go higher. They should go at least to 1250 and possibly back to their highs. If you think that there will be a recession, then stocks are too high and probably have to go to at least 850, which is about 250 points lower than where we are now, 300 points lower than we are now. And in a really bad recession in which, you know, Europe falls apart, unravels basically, and Asia follows, then there's no question that the S&P will go back to its 2009 low.
Charles Nenner
was on. You need to answer that question in your own mind.
Right.
Because, you know, the people who say that prices are too low are not looking, they always preface their statement by saying something like, there will be no double-dip recession.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they always start with.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go on to the others, which are true. Short-term interest rates are anchored at zero. That's mm-hmm. true. Inflation and inflationary expectations are contained. That's true, and that's very important for a bull market. Corporate balance sheets are strong, and earnings growth has been strong as well. And that's important, and that's both true. Valuations based on past results are low, and that is true. They are low.
Mm-hmm.
The yield on S&P 500 stocks is lower than the 10-year note. That's true. Investors' expectations are limited. That's also true. Hedge funds have de-risked. That's true. Okay. And retail investors have basically abandoned the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not completely true, but it's true enough for what we're talking about. So all those things are accurate. Now, and are facts. The only thing that's not a fact and that's an opinion is whether there's going to be a recession or not. And that's why you really have to determine in your own mind. Now, for my own self, I like to lean on the opinion of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, led by Lakshman Akhman.
Now, that's impressive that you could say his name. That's good.
I've been talking to Lakshman for about almost two decades now, and his cycle work is fantastic
yep.
at being able to call a recession when it's 3 to 6 months away. His weekly leading indicator is declining in a pervasive,
mm-hmm.
profound way, and my expectation is that it's not too far away from him using that to declare that a recession is on the way. If and when that happens, he does that. That will still not be a mainstream point of view because
mm-hmm.
his cycle work is still considered to be outside the mainstream. However, it was a fascinating interview last night on Bloomberg out of Wyoming with Martin Feldstein, who was is a Harvard economist, mm-hmm. and was actually head of the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the organization that actually dates recessions.
Wasn't he also in the movie Young Frankenstein?
he looks like a little like Igor. Yeah.
Oh, that was Marty Feldman. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, that's a different one. So Feldstein's considered a very, very good mainstream economist. Uh-huh. He said something that actually kind of shocked me last night. He said that he sees a better than 50% chance of recession. He says that if there is a recession, he thinks it will probably be dated back. The start of it will have been dated back in December 2010.
Wow.
And he said it's also possible that when they go back and sift through the data, they may decide that the recession of 2008 never ended.
Hmm.
So there's actually three scenarios he mentioned. One is that the recession never ended. The second is that that we are currently in what they call a double dip, which is you have a recession, and then you have two quarters of growth, and then a new recession, and that's a possibility. And the third possibility is that you had a recession, you had four quarters of growth, and now we're having a new recession.
Right.
So at any rate, you know, he thinks there's better than 50% chance that there will be determined a recession because growth is clearly slowing down to the zero bound. Okay. Now, you could also say, well, if there's a 50% chance there will be, there's a 50% chance there won't be.
Right, yeah.
And that's true, too. And that's why this is really a pivotal moment. Investors really have to decide for themselves, you know, in using the data and also using your intuition, which is helpful. You know, are we entering a recession? When I come in contact with people who have contact with the public or in business, I always ask them, you know, how's business? You know, how are your customers? How do you think people? In your view, from the ground, how do you see business today? And I would say that most of the people that I talk to, at least in the Seattle area and where I've traveled in the Colorado and Florida recently, most people don't think that what they are seeing constitutes a extreme slowdown.
Hmm.
I just had a discussion with my tennis partner last night, who is a loan officer, and he's very much has an opportunity to see all sections of the economy here in the Seattle area. And he says most of his customers are still taking loans and they're growing. So I thought that was very optimistic.
Well, we're not going to talk right now about the fact that you're in Florida and I didn't hear from you when you were down here, but that will do another time. What I think is interesting and fascinating is that probably some of Feldstein's work was based on, or his new opinion is based on, the fact that we had this recent revision going back, I guess, a year and a half, that chopped off about $400 billion. I mean, we're not talking about a rounding error at this point. $400 billion worth of our GDP over the last few years, which is pretty, I think that pretty much shocked people, because I do believe there's a section of people who believe that the government has been very optimistic somehow in a lot of their data. And you don't want to think that. You want to hope that the data is clean.
You want to hope that the data is clean, but you got to remember, a lot of it is not really data per se; it's models, or sort of synthetic views of what the data is showing. So you kind of have to take some of these revisions with a grain of salt. Also, just to throw out a little bone for the conspiracy theorists out there, you know, there are a lot of people who think that the government manipulates the GDP data for its own benefit. And you know, you would say, like, why would it benefit anybody for the economy to be seen weaker than it is today? Well, if you're the administration and you're not running for office today, you're running for office in 9 months to a year or a year and a half. It benefits you to have the data, the economy seem poor now, but improve later after you've had a chance to work your well-publicized miracles.
Hmm.
So, you know, if the economy is weak now, let's say unemployment at 9%, GDP at, you know, let's say 1% to be generous. But the headlines in a year from now, when people are starting to focus on the conventions, say that the unemployment is at, let's say, 8% or 7%, and GDP growth is trucking along at more like 3%, then the administration can say that they've improved things and they're on the right track.
Right.
So can they do that? They absolutely can. Will they do that? Do they do that? I think that most administrations will admit that they do something like that, you know, by putting pressure on various, you know, data releasing organizations, you know, within your organization, whether it's Commerce or BLS, Do I have any evidence of it? I don't.
Right.
I don't have any evidence, but I do suspect that it happens.
Let me get back to the ECR.
And by the way, when you read the memoirs of former members of government, they certainly hint to it.
Yeah, no kidding. It's only after the fact. It's almost like the fascinating amazing metamorphosis of Greenspan, who was just totally, spoke in a language that nobody understood at all in any of his tenure as Fed chief. But as soon as he seemed like put a book out, you understood everything he said when he goes on talk shows. It's like, who's this guy? You know?
Yep.
So, but going back to Lashman and the ECRI, I track that. I think I've sent you some of my charts of that on a weekly basis.
Yeah, you do amazing data work.
Yeah, colors are good, right? We like the colors.
Yep.
Kind of tells the story three-dimensionally a bit. But he also puts out the growth rate. And his growth rate numbers, there's a bunch of different things he puts out, but he puts out a weekly index, the leading index, which obviously is more current than the monthly that's put out by the current conference board. Conference board. And then there's also he also puts out that, and he puts out the growth rate, the leading growth rate. And that's interesting because that, I think, for the first time in a very long time, actually, has dipped under zero.
Yeah, you got to be a little careful with that because it's not the growth rate of the economy, it's the growth rate of the index.
Right, no, I understand.
And so he's measuring the acceleration and deceleration of his index. So it doesn't provide any information. What's really important is which way is the index headed, and is it moving in a profound and pervasive way?
Yeah, I think it dropped another 1.5 points or something like that. 2.5%. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, but, you know, if things start to stabilize, you know, there's a lot of interesting factors in that model. You know, some of it's the stock market. Some of it is, you know, housing starts. Some of it is I kid you not, the price of tallow and cardboard.
No, that's important. Shipping.
He likes to look at commodities that aren't priced by the market. In other words, that are priced internally by companies, rather there's no futures contracts because he thinks that those are more real.
Right.
So the index has a way of looking around the corners. So even though we're kind of expecting that it's directional, I've seen very many times in the past where it kind of turns the corner when nobody's looking.
Yeah.
When no one's expecting it. So I would wait. I would wait for him to give the call.
Yeah.
He's
so,
the expert.
So here's the question I have, though. This is something I think has to be explored because even though I hate saying this time is different, I'm not talking about a this time is different thing. I'm talking about how some of the nature of what goes into a company's profits are different now than, let's say, they were 2 decades ago. So, for example, I'm not sure what the difference is between a 0.1 growth rate on GDP and a negative 0.1, if you understand what I'm saying, that fine line that would say, oh, you're in a recession. I mean, does everybody just start freaking out in the streets when they call a recession, or is it just, you know, hey, we're in a very slow growth rate? But here's the thing. I do agree that there are two components here. There's a global issue and there's a U.S. issue. I'm not so sold on the fact that if the U.S. goes into a recession or at least we continue on the slow path, that necessarily is a terrible thing for, let's say, a certain grouping of stocks. The stock market may, I hate to use this also, decouple a little bit, certain stocks, because they're much more global dependent these days when you see that they are having a lot of their income from other areas.
Well, there's no doubt that certainly elite group of large cap internationals are doing quite well even right now.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the stocks of McDonald's, Kimberly-Clark, Coca-Cola, a few others, you would say, you know, what the market slide, you know, what recession, everything looks hunky-dory.
Yep.
And these companies, you know, are sell to, you know, emerging markets and have to have most of their earnings overseas today. But I would caution you, if there is a recession, a real recession, that gathers strength and has a negative feedback loop, that's really important. Once a recession starts, it has a reinforcing negative effect. It will drag. It's almost certain to drag down the rest of the world. It's almost unavoidable. And not only that, but you know, in our discussion, we've only been talking about the United States. But and the reason that people like my loan officer friend and that people who are pretty optimistic about the U.S. market may be missing the boat is that they're really underestimating the effect that a banking crisis in Europe can have on the United States.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And there is a banking crisis. As a matter of fact, the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde.
Yeah.
We need to Smiths and Jones again to make it easier. But this weekend said that there is an urgent necessity to have the European banks raise their capital requirements and shore up their balance sheets to avoid a catastrophe. And, you know, it seems like one day we're fine, one day we're not. Greek yields on their bonds went up to about 42.5% last week, a record
high.
When
you say the yields on their bonds, what that doesn't say is that that's the amount that Greek people need to pay to roll over the country's debt. So whereas we pay, you know, less than 1% for short-term money in the United States, and, you know, 3.5% or whatever for 10-year money. So the Greeks are paying literally 40% per annum to roll over their debt. Well, that's pawnbroker money, and that's not sustainable.
Right.
So, you know, if that continues, and there really doesn't seem to be much will to prevent that from happening,
yeah,
you know, Greece is going to default, you know, and it's a horrible thing to say. But it's not benign, because if Greece defaults, there's a whole line, there's a long line of effects that can tumble from that, which are not pretty. And, you know, people make fun of Greece by saying it's, you know, less than this, has an economy less than the size of Maryland. Well, that's not the point. The point is that if European banks have to take a haircut on what they're owed by the Greek government, they need to either be made whole or they need to raise their capital requirements. They need to raise their reserves, and they don't have the money for that.
Right, and who wants to give it to them? Because then,
who's going to give it to them?
Right, if you give it to them, you're essentially saying, okay, here's money because we know you're going to get a haircut. Why would you do such a thing?
Exactly, and not only that, but you know, those, you know, the Europeans depend on this crazy system called the Eurozone.
Oh, what a mess!
Which is kind of a mess. They have the same currency, but they don't have a treasury. They don't have a taxation force. They don't even have an agreement on what to do if one of the members gets in trouble. They have an emergency agreement right now called EFSF, which sort of papered over the problems back in the spring. But there's really no agreement among the Europeans, particularly the Germans, who are the richest country in Europe, as to whether that emergency fund is even valid, much less whether they will pay out for it.
And a couple of things, John. Number one, regarding that, they ponied up $1 trillion, you know, or so in that, and kind of pulled some money to protect what they thought would be, you know, kind of a shock and awe campaign, and that helped for a little while. The second thing was that the ECB. It's interesting. The ECB has literally put up money with no different than what we did here in the Fed, where they printed money to buy the bonds and to do what they did. They don't want to buy the bonds of Greece and of Italy and all that. And they don't have enough money, actually, to cover anything more than a breakdown, really, in Greece. That's it. There's no other money. And then you got to say, where's the money going to come from? Well, Germany is just pissed off as can be. You know, they're the one economy that was the center holding point, the keel of the whole entire area, and they're just getting slammed. I think the citizens there are pissed off. They're putting Mercedes on fire all over the place. You have France, by the way, which I think is the biggest problem here. Because France owns the largest amount, and the banks in France, Société Générale and all these, they own the largest amount of the worst debt that's out there. Five of their banks did not pass the stress test, which was, you know, questionable to begin with, out of the 10 or so that entirely didn't pass in the region. Five or so of the French banks didn't pass. So, you know, you're looking at a situation there that is almost like a gigantic snowball that just will not stop, because while Trichet is all for bailouts, because, of course, he's from France and he wants that to happen, Merkel's like, what are you talking about? Are you out of your minds?
And you're talking about Angela Merkel, who's the Chancellor of Germany, and
right.
Trichet, who's the head of the European Central Bank.
Right.
And you're right. These are real issues. And over here in the United States, you know, my loan officer friend, who thinks that business is fine, you know, he's not looking at that. If you're just a technician looking at the stock market in the United States, you're not looking at that. And I do think that we're vulnerable to being blindsided by those issues.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that how closely connected their U.S. banks are with the European debt. I read a really interesting stat over the weekend. Up to 40% of U.S. money market money is invested in short-term in commercial paper of European banks. And that money is on the U.S. government has quietly told U.S. banks to stop that practice and basically bring back their money. Okay?
Yep.
And that is contributing
right
to the funding crisis in Europe. It is helping shore up the U.S. relationship shore up the potential for problems with U.S. banks, but it also exacerbates the problems with the European banks.
Right. And then, you know, people, I think, are, that's why this whole discussion from the Fed, I think it was 2 weeks ago, quietly on the weekend, Bernanke said, you know what, we want an accounting of what the risk is here. Because we're also seeing that the interbank lending rates are quietly creeping higher. You know, in the height of the meltdown of Lehman, there was this LIBOR spread that we talk about that was kind of moving, and it got, you know, like 3% at that point. It was the interbank lending, basically, and the spread between the U.S. and the European. And the problem was that the overnight lending got ridiculous. I mean, it was nobody would lend to each other. The banks, you know, which are very apt to, like you said, lend back and forth and create liquidity, weren't doing it. And we have a liquidity problem that's building up pretty fast here.
And one of the things that's kind of curious right now is that LIBOR is not moving up as quickly strongly as it did during the last crisis. So you can take that two ways. You know, either that's a good thing. It is moving up, by the way, but not at the accelerated rate that we saw during the 2008 crisis. It is. You can say that it's a good thing, and maybe concerns are overblown, or you can say it's coming.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think about Japan? I mean, Japan is quietly also a lot of quiet things going on. I have a really interesting question for you after this too about Japan. But Japan is now in a recession, right? They have 3/4 of negative GDP.
Right.
And what I find fascinating about that is that there's a lot of talk. Well, look what happened because of the earthquake. The GDP negative print, the first one was before the earthquake.
Yeah, well, you know, poor Japan.
Poor Japan.
A country that I love and I've studied for many years. You know, they were the second largest economy in the world after the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been passed by China and by Europe. But you know, you can't just sort of wave your hand and say, "Oh, Japan, it doesn't matter. They've been out of it for a long time." Still the second, the third or fourth largest economy in the world. And when they're not buying stuff, when they're not buying metal, when they're not buying tissue paper, when they're not buying Coca-Cola, because the economy is shrinking and their prospects are thinning, it's a big problem for the rest of the world. You know, it's really a drag.
But when they have their I was at there's a mall by me here called the Sawgrass Mall, which probably everybody that's been to Florida and Fort Lauderdale has gone to. And I was there last night, and I walked out of a restaurant, and my mouth just kind of gaped open because there was all these people walking, not only with bags in their hand. I mean, there were like 6 or 7 shopping bags that they kind of wrapped around each hand and were walking with these gigantic things like it was Christmas. And I'm thinking to myself, uh-huh. What's going on here? You know, all right, I could say, okay, you know, things are getting better. I could say it's just, you know, retail sales in this area are good, or they're all coming to this mall. But it was, you know what, it was all foreigners. And, you know, you look at Japan, and the cost of their goods for us to buy is prohibitive. It's just ridiculous, which is why they have such a deflationary problem there.
Right, and it's so strong.
Yeah, and on the other side, though, they could pretty much buy 3-to-1 of ours compared to what they used to. And so you know, they're not buying locally. They're buying, you know, they're buying their stuff outside if they can.
Well, you know, there's a whole host of things, you know, psychologically speaking, in Japan going on right now that most Americans are not aware of. One of them is that in the wake of the tsunami, earthquake and tsunami, there is a sense, a culture of self-denial that's grown up. Whereas, you know, if people were suffering, my neighbors were suffering, then I should suffer too. And there is a tremendous a weakening of demand. I don't know about your shoppers all the way down there in Florida. They're probably from Latin America.
Yeah, definitely.
But but in Japan, on top of everything else, there's been a culture that journalists have written about there of self-denial that continues to this day as part of the mourning process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you add that to the declining, you know, growth rate and the declining family formation rate in Japan, And it's really a country that's unfortunately in decline and has a political system that is just paralyzed from moving forward. So you have to, you know, it's kind of an old story, but it's still an important story that Japan is a drag on the world economy.
Yeah, well, actually, the prime minister resigned this weekend under pressure and shame over what happened or didn't happen, maybe, due to the Fukushima incident and the bad cleanup process and maybe the oversight. And then I think this is the sixth change in a matter of within 10 years there.
So the Japanese government.
Yep, which is pretty substantial. And again, he resigned in shame and et cetera. But why is it that a few months ago, and this I thought was the most fascinating thing, I wrote about this in our, I think the last quarterly or the quarterly before that new commentary that we put out to our clients. Why is it that there was this gigantic desire to invest in Japan right after the stock market broke down, saying that, you know, this isn't going to be anything, an economist saying this Japanese earthquake and tsunami is not going to have any effect on world growth? And what were they thinking?
You know, that's just one of those knee-jerk reactions people have, that, you know, that you want to buy something that's broken down. Certainly that's part of the whole value of mantra. I never really saw it, and I still don't see it. I think Japan is still in a void in my books.
Yeah, I hear you. So let's go to a discussion about. I know that you write a few newsletters. What are how many newsletters are you writing now? Two?
I write three newsletters.
Three.
I write a Trader's Advantage, mm-hmm. which is a daily report in which we try to buy stocks and ETFs that are making 3 to 10 day moves.
Mm-hmm.
And as well as options on those. And I also wrote a letter called Strategic Advantage, which mm-hmm. People can see at my website, markmecapital.net. And that's a long-term letter focused on ETFs and individual stocks. And then I also have a new newsletter, which I've published since March, called Gemini 252. People can look that up on the web, Gemini, just like the astrological sign, 252, which is the number of trading days in a year, Gemini252.com. And that's focused on futures. And it's, you know, I love all my newsletters, and they all do well and have lots of happy subscribers, fortunately. But Gemini 252 is the most exciting for me recently because using the futures market, we've been able to basically move against the majority at risk at critical times. It's a very much counter-trend-oriented approach. And we've been able to make money for our subscribers in every month this year, including August.
Wow.
August so
great.
Far, August so far, the market's down 10%. Trades in the letter are up almost 8%.
Wow,
and
that's
fantastic.
For the year,
Gemini is up 73%.
Oh, that's it. That's
about it. 8%.
Ah, I thought it was gonna be more than that. Oh, come on.
The thing is. When you think about futures trading, thanks, Andrew.
Yeah,
thanks
no, the I'm kidding. That's unbelievable.
When you think about futures trading, you think about day trading. You think about these rooms full of day traders. Well, that's not what we do. What Gemini does is it has an opinion about three instruments: the S&P 500 E-mini, the Russell 2000 E-mini, and the 2-year note futures.
Mm-hmm.
And every day it chooses as to which one of those three instruments it wants to be involved in, and whether it wants to be long or short. But it only actually trades about 7 or 8 times a month because mm-hmm. it has very strict criteria. It doesn't get dragged into every market. In fact, when markets are hyper-volatile,
mm-hmm.
it stands aside, which mm-hmm. is part of the reason that it's been able to be successful. But it doesn't shy away from risk. It very often will tell our subscribers to buy at the end of a very hard down day. Let's say the market's down 4%,
mm-hmm.
you'll get a signal from us that says buy. And very often, the algorithm behind the Gemini sees an opportunity for the market to rise the next morning. And so if you buy at the end of a hard down day, you're out at the beginning of the next day into a surge. And, you know, a 10, 15 point, you know, 16 point move in the S&P 500 futures, because it's leveraged, is good for, you know, even if the move is only 1%.
Yeah, it's good for 3.
For a portfolio, it's good for 4 or 5%.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. And you're still writing for MarketWatch?
Yeah, and I still write a column for Market Watch as well.
So
that's the online division of the Wall Street Journal.
Right. So one of the things that I know that you really have a passion about, or at least that you've that I'll share with people that I know of, by the way, is your seasonality. I know that you have a lot of experience with the whole idea of a seasonality. Now, seasonality takes a lot of different shapes and forms. I know some very well respected people who report on the lunar cycle, which I can't do that. I can't, on the tides and all
works,
that.
The lunar cycle works for gold.
Yeah, okay, but that says it all right there. But one of the things that we've getting into now is a very strange time of the year where Septembers have probably been one of the worst periods of time, and then kind of fast forward into the final quarter of the year has been one of the better times of market performance. So when you look at this situation, there's a lot of other things you need to put into it, right? You need to put in what kind of economy you in, what is the cycle there. I mean, we just talked a little while ago with Charles Nenner, who is all about the idea of cycles, and predicted something like a 500 point level for the S&P 500 is his prediction. What is the kind of overlying cycles right now when it comes to, or seasonality, I should say, about the markets and over the next, through the end of the year?
Sure. Well, for the next week, cycles are usually up for the last week of August, first week of September, are usually positive, not always, but positive. September is, as most people know by now, typically one of the worst 2 months of the year for the S&P 500. And October typically features bottoms. It's one of the most frequent. If you look at the stock market over the past 100 years, a preponderance of bottoms have happened in October, something like 10 out of the 20.
Hmm.
And why is that? It's not because of the moon or the winter or anything like that. Because obviously, only half of the the world is going into winter. The other half is going into summer.
Right. And it's right, exactly. It's light sometimes a day. It's dark sometimes. So who knows, right?
Exactly. It's not about that. It's about corporate earnings. It's about when you're in a weak year in particular, and people are worried about earnings going into the fourth quarter. They seem to crescendo their concerns into the third week of October, because that is the heaviest week of S&P 500 earnings that are reporting back on the third year, on the third quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a time when companies issue their forecasts for the fourth quarter and usually also for the next year.
Right.
And when you're in a negative cycle and companies are reporting weak earnings for the third quarter, they're usually also offering a poor outlooks for the fourth quarter and the next year, and it's that crescendo of fear and worry that takes markets down into October.
Well, we're setting up pretty well for that, to be honest.
And then
after you've had a
washout, usually the market overcorrects.
Yeah.
And that's what you see. That's what shows up as the sharp rises in November and December.
And one of the things that happens also end of
that
month.
Makes sense,
yeah, no, it totally makes sense. I mean, one of the things that happens also is that we get this end of month, and it's been a bit exasperated or exaggerated lately, is we see this end of month, beginning of the month move where there's this rotation. I mean, when you see a market such as the bond market move up so dramatically and the stock market move down, there are just a ton of balanced funds and balanced players that will do reversion to the mean concept or just a normal asset allocation rebalance.
Really, it's not really a concept so much as it's part of their covenants.
Yeah, right, I understand.
Just to expand on what you're saying, I totally agree. It's called, the hedge fund guys call it a tactical asset allocation trade, TAA trade. And when you have a month, such as August, in which bonds are up a lot and stocks are down a lot, pension funds and sections of pension funds, which are supposed to be equity income balanced, typically have a balance, a target balance in their covenant that say they need to be 60% stocks, 40% bonds. So when the value of the bonds goes way up and the value of stocks goes way down, at the end of the month, they typically rebalance in that tactical asset allocation trade. And that's part of what accounts for a surge in stocks and a decline in bonds at the end of a month. And at the end of a month, such as the one we just witnessed.
Right, so talking about the next 4 or 5 days, potentially into the beginning of the month. And then you have the next thing, which is the beginning of the month, which a lot of pension plans put money to work because they've gathered money from their participants in deposits, and they're putting fresh money to work at that point, which also has to be allocated properly.
Right, and that's why the first day of the month, you know, if you look at it, every first day of the month over time, you'll see that there is a slightly exaggerated up move at the first day of the month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not perfect, you know, and as soon as you have a string of them, you know, four or five in a row that are just fantastic first days of the month, you're bound to have another one, the next one go down.
Yeah.
But yes, there is a positive bias to the first day of the month.
So let's kind of just finish up with some of the more recent things that have occurred, and putting into the focus, for example, the Bernanke non-event, where he signaled pretty much nothing other than that at his next meeting he's going to have a two-day event, which, you know, some people are taking as there's going to be that so they can explain further monetary policy. There's also the idea that he didn't do anything, therefore maybe it's not as bad as we think. And so what's your take on how his speech went on?
Well, first of all, I kind of reject the whole idea of big man economics, you know, where one man has an outsized effect on everybody else.
I'm glad you said that. I was just thinking that this way. I said, what? Everybody says there's negative news coming. This one guy says it's positive, so everybody moves up stocks. It's crazy, right?
It is crazy. And, you know, Bernanke's point of view on the stock market and on inflation versus deflation is very well known. You know, he's an inflator. You know, in Bernanke's mind, the worst thing that can happen to an economy is deflation. He's an expert on the Depression, and that has colored all of the work he did as an academic in Princeton. He was also very much involved with helping the United States government's effort to help Japan during the beginning stages of their deflation. So he believes that the worst thing that can happen to an economy is deflation. And I think we all agree that that's correct. So, if you think that the United States is in danger of suffering a decline in prices, then Bernanke will be there with monetary policy to help out. And that's one of the reasons that he's extended the zero bound of U.S. federal funds rates for 2 years, and has kept all other means of providing liquidity to the market ample. But right now, if you think about it from his perspective, the inflation-deflation argument has changed quite a bit since last year. Yep. You know, last year, prices were declining, and that was a real threat of this deflation. So QE2, the second round of quantitative easing, was intended to blunt that decline in prices.
Mm-hmm.
But if you fast forward to a year from then, which is right now, you know, inflation is running at about 2%. So in his mind, quantitative easing has done its job, and he doesn't feel as if it's necessary to do another round of easing. And in fact, he said in his speech, and he said before, that there's only so much that monetary policy can do.
Mm-hmm.
That fiscal government officials need to do their role as well. And if you notice in his speech, he didn't call for, you know, the usual, you know, deficit reduction or stimulus spending. He said a prudent and balanced approach to both, and I think that's very wise. And I think that the market reacted to him positively because, you know, he acted as they expect him to do, not panicky, not reacting to the market per se, but staying true to his character. And staying true to his character is what gives investors comfort.
So do you think that...
They want to be able to predict his behavior.
Right. Do you think that if he would have done more quantitative easing, that would have been positive or negative?
I think it would have been taken as a negative because it would have suggested that he's throwing out his usual rule book about trying to use quantitative easing to blunt deflation.
Right.
People don't see deflation per se today, except in housing prices.
Right. I think I'm pretty pleased as well that he didn't do it, because I think that would have been... I think they've been asking for a lot of trouble, potentially.
Well, you know, you can say that, you know, keeping rates as low as they have always led to imbalances in the economy. It's certainly keeping rates as low as he did back in following 9/11, you know, led to a rebound in 2003 for the market. I'm talking about Greenspan.
Mm-hmm.
But it also created balances where housing prices got you know, it was so cheap to buy a mortgage that the cost of houses became ridiculously cheap and led to a bubble that led to the next crisis.
Right.
So without doubt, keeping interest rates this low for this long will have some negative effect down the road. We just don't know exactly what it'll be.
Well, I think it's been the exported inflation, and that led to higher food prices, which has led to riots throughout the Middle East. I think that's a major issue.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, it doesn't have to only be here, because what we're doing here is, you know, the continual deflation of the dollar, which is a big problem. And then we, you know, we ratchet up everything else. People are, I think there's a lot of, there is one piece of disappointment, I think, about the QE was that if you look at back at QE2 when it started, I think one of the add-ons to not only avoiding deflation was obviously to help employment, but that didn't do it, and to create this wealth effect. The problem, though, is we're right back where we started and all the money spent. So now there has to be a little bit of a different mix done, and maybe this twisting idea or whatever it is.
Well, you have to understand what quantitative easing really is and what it isn't. You know, the traditional way that central banks affect inflation, which is the prices of money, which is their primary goal, it's the monetary supply stability. Their primary way that they affect it is by raising and lowering interest rates through a variety of complicated means. Once you have lowered interest rates to zero, what they call the zero bound, then central banks realize that they need another or a supplementary method of affecting pricing. And that's what quantitative easing is. So all these quantitative easing methods, QE1 and QE2 and potentially QE3, are experiments in trying to figure out how to affect monetary policy when you can't raise and lower interest rates. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And the funny thing is, just to get back to what you first said about his background in education, is that he was one of the people that helped out the Japanese government figure out what they were going to do to fight their deflation problem. And just as a point of reference, it didn't work. And secondly, we are experiencing now a round of the same kind of move, which you want to say it did stabilize the pricing here. Well, that's great. But again, it you know, at what cost? And then I guess further on, you look at Japan's situation with a bloated, the largest debt in terms of dollar value or yen value.
In terms of whether it worked or not in Japan, I will defend Bernanke and even Geithner in that regard. The Japanese did not do what they said, what the U.S. recommended. And they did it in a Japanese way. So you gotta give them a little wave off on that score.
Okay.
But understand that, you know, that economics is not in the science department at colleges for a very good reason.
Right.
You know, there are no firm economic rules other than, you know, supply and demand. So economics has to do with psychology. You know, how are people going to react given various stimuli from levels of inflation and levels of interest rates, et cetera. And it's unpredictable. So almost everything that the economists do, whether it's QE1 or QE2, possibly QE3, think of it as a giant worldwide experiment.
And my bank account is then in that experiment the rat.
Yes, your bank account is the rat, and you know the government officials they think that they're doing the right thing based on the models that are prevalent in today's academic world. But, you know, they may be proven wrong. And, you know, 50 years from now, academics may look back and point to this era and they say, how could they have gotten it so wrong?
Right.
On the other hand, you know, maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe the economists will look back and say, you know what? Bernanke was a smart man. He stood his ground. He did what he thought was right based on the modeling that he was able to do at the time. And the United States and Europe came out of it without.
I'll share this with you that if they don't get
but
it,
we
right,
don't. I just want to. What I emphasize here is that, you know, we are in the middle of the experiment. But yep. We truly don't know exactly how it's going to end up.
Yeah. And if it does end up badly, let's say that it doesn't work out for, let's just say, 5, 7, 10 years, and then all of a sudden there is some growth that happens on the other side. I guarantee you that 25 or 30 years from now, if the same thing happens, they'll go back to the same playbook. But that's another story. Let me ask you this question in closing. And then, you know, you're well-read, and I know that you've written some fabulous books. I get a lot of questions from listeners. They want to know, you know, what are good books to read, you know, aside from ours, what are good books to read to learn about investing, or maybe futures, for example, from our discussion, or economics? What can, you know, this is, I didn't ask you to prepare for this, but is there anything you can think of?
Well, you know, one of my favorite books is How to Make Money in Stocks by William O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone who's just starting out in investing should read that book. He's the man behind the Investor's Business Daily. And to me, that book has just a treasure chest of information about how to deal with stocks. If you want to be a trader and you want to learn more about the psychology of charts and whatnot, Stan Weinstein's book,
mm-hmm.
How to Prosper in Bull and Bear Markets, is terrific. It's an oldie but goodie. It's only available in paperback. It's really good. I think from a standpoint of psychology and learning about history of the stock market, which is extremely important, I would recommend the book that I published 2 years ago, which was an annotated edition of Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. We talked about it on your show.
Wait, that's 2 years ago? That's not 2 years ago. Really?
Came out in the end of 2008.
Really? Wow.
Beginning of 2009.
I thought it was like 6 months ago. I swear. It seems like it was yesterday. Seriously.
Well, what's interesting about it, Andrew, not to promote my own book, but that book was written in 1923 about the exploits of the top trader of the early 1900s, 1910s, 1920s. And it explains in the original book, it explains all the trials and tribulations that this trader went through during that era. And then my annotations layer on top of that an explanation of what was actually happening in mm-hmm. the economy and the stock market, both at that time as well as the times that book is referring to, which is the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, and then later on the 1930s and 40s. So you get a very interesting textured explanation of how the market has reacted from the 1860s to the 1920s. And it's amazing to me how similar what we're going through today is to that era. You learn a lot just by going back and seeing the history and saying, wow, that happened before? Really? And this is what happened next? Interesting.
You know, so, John, you know what that's like?
I think it's a very useful guide.
Yeah, you know what that's like? You know, it's kind of like, let me just share something. Some people may be thinking, oh, I'm going to read something about the 20s. What does that have to do today? Well, if you have any religion in you for a minute, it's kind of like, what's the Bible of that was written centuries many, many years ago? What does it have to do with today? I mean, you can take the Bible and pretty much put that into use in everyday items. No, we don't have horses and but we do have cars, transportation, et cetera. If your book was, if the original book, Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, was the Bible, in Judaism we'd say that your book that you did is the Midrash.
Okay.
You ever hear that before?
Sure.
It's perfect, right?
Yeah, it's perfect.
Which is just late, for those of you who know, it's basically the Midrash gives a...
It's commentary from the rabbis.
Right, from the rabbis on the... Rabbi, thank you very much for that book.
Well, the reason I mention it in particular is that, and this is a very hopeful thing, the 1920s, in the popular imagination are called the Roaring Twenties, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You think about the dances, the Lindy and whatnot.
Right, Prohibition.
You think about stock market running up to at the high in October of 1929. But the first half of that decade, from like 1919 to 1924, were terrible. I mean, it was very much like today because they were coming off of a lost decade, the period of 1900 to 1910. You had horrible, cataclysmic world events. You had the World War II, which killed 30 million people. You had the Spanish plague, which killed 40 million people in 1918, 1919. You had a terrible depression in the end of 1919 after the end of World War I. And in the first couple of years in the decade, which are similar to what we're going through right now, 1920, 1921, 1922, people were just wandering around wondering, thinking that it was really the end of time. You have a lot of, you can look at the novels of that era, particularly from people like F. Scott Fitzgerald, and they all show a terrible despair about how horrible the world is. But 1921, 1922, things started. 1922 and 1923, things started to turn around. 1924, radio came into fashion. Talkies began. 1925, stock market started to rev up again, and it was only the final the last 5 years of that era that were considered to be the real Roaring Twenties. And if you were in the in the middle of it, just like we're right here at the end of, just like we're right here at the end of 2011, they would be at the end of 1921. There is absolutely no way a person in 1921 could have ever imagined that the 20s would end up to be a terrific decade. And I actually think that we have there's a possibility that we'll look back and say the same thing.
Yep.
That after all the turmoil of 2008, 2009, the repercussions that we've seen in the most recent couple of years, and whatever might be ahead of us in 2012, 2013, I think we will have a washout of economy, history, whatever, in 2013-2014, and have a possibility for a terrific second half of the decade.
Well, I guess that's kind of like what I always say, that one thing we haven't had up to this point was what happens in nature, which is in a forest, when it gets overgrown, when it gets to a point that it is overpopulated, and it's just a normal cycle, that you'll see a major forest fire, and then from the ground, it grows up much stronger over the next, however many years into the future, and that's a necessary part of the process. We nobody let anything burn to the ground this time. I mean, one or two things here or there.
I think that it's possible that you really need. I hate to say it, it would hurt a lot of people, but you do need a lot of that debt that was acquired in the last decade to be extinguished, and that's what would create a firm foundation. And basically, that's what. The economics left to their own devices in Europe would happen. That's what would happen. All the money that was invested in Greece and Spain and in Italy and all those bad bonds, it would just go bust. People who lent the money would go bankrupt, and you'd have basically a depression. And then after that, new saplings, new shoots would grow up, and you'd have a terrific end of the.
As long as we don't hear
all these efforts that we're trying to make now are trying to prevent natural. Events from happening, and
right.
the longer you keep those the natural events under control, possibly the more explosive the reaction of nature will be.
And I think that's what Bernanke was trying to bring to us when he started his ever famous green shoots conversation back in the lowest points of 2008, 2009. John Markman.
Oh yes.
John Markman, I got to tell you, thank you. Always insightful and wonderful to have you. You have such an amazing breadth of knowledge. Markman, here, my friend, does newsletters that you need to check out, and he has some great writings. You have to go to markmancapital.net. Don't go to .com. We don't know that's going to take you. Markmancapital.net, and that'll kind of direct you everywhere. We'll have links for all of his information on the show notes for this particular episode. Just go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Just look at the top there. It says show notes. Big button on the top says show notes. You click that, and it will just bring up the last number of episodes, and you'll see all the different things that you need to see there. So I wish you luck, and I'm glad to hear that your Gemini project is working very well.
Thank you very much. And if people are interested in the Gemini program, I'll tell you what, they can write me directly, and I'll send them a link and information about it.
Okay.
They can just email to me directly at john@gemini252.com.
Now, how do you spell John?
It's J-O-N.
Uh-huh.
J-O-N at gemini252.com, or they can also write me at John, J-O-N, at markmancapital.com.
And I'll put both those links on the site as well, because nobody's, we don't ever remember things. It's going so fast here. All right, we'll talk to you. And by the way, next time I am in Seattle, I promise I won't visit you, just like you didn't obviously visit me when you came to Florida. How's
well,
that?
I hope that's not true. I'd love to take you out to the beautiful Puget Sound.
All right, I'll see you soon. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This is Andrew Horowitz. Thanks for joining me. Anything that you need, feel free to write to me. Any questions you have at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And, I have a list here. I have probably three or four or five really good questions that came in from a few people. So just to let you know that, who do we have here? We have Don B, and we have Mike, and we have Kate, and we have, there's one more here, somewhere here. Anyway, we're going to have some questions answered next week, and then, of course, we know we have a little bit of a shortened week coming up because of Labor Day, and you should be aware that the following week and the following Friday is the labor number from the official source, so we're going to see what the unemployment rate is and how that's going to affect markets. Should be pretty interesting to see. And that's one of the big things that people go look for to see really over the corner. Well, is there going to be the recession that we talked about a minute ago or not? So check that out. And of course, if you are kind of in that mode that you're undecided what to do, you're scared, you're just not, you don't have the ability to really make any kind of commitments right now because you're not sure of what's going on with the markets and you'd rather just not even pay attention. Well, you know what? That's what we're here for. We manage money also. We have a minimum of $50,000 for a managed account. All you have to do is go to the website, The Disciplined Investor, and check out the link that says, see the virtual tour. And there's a virtual tour about 12 minutes long that you can check out to see how we manage money. We have a private client website when you become a client, so you can see what we're writing about each and every day. And we trade. We go long. We go short. We use options. We'll be in the market, out of the market. It's kind of like a, in a way, a hedge fund strategy without a hedge fund. It's definitely not a hedge fund. So it's your own account, and you have total access to it and ownership of it. No commingling. So check that out. I really encourage you, if you haven't seen it yet, to check it out. And then otherwise, we'll see you next week. Keep the questions coming. Keep the comments coming. And make sure that you keep your iTunes or your Zoom or your wherever you listen to it plugged in for this and the Winning Investor as well as DH Unplugged. I'll see you next week. Have a profitable week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.